Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, the podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, I have two very special guests today. I have Dr. Ganesh Tite, who is Emeritus Professor at Tilak Maharashtra Vidyapeeth from Pune, currently in Pune, and also his co-author, Dr. Yonut Moisi, Research Fellow at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, a colleague of mine at the OCHS. And by the power of the internet, we have a call here between North America, India, and the UK. Welcome both to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and my pleasure, my pleasure. And we will be speaking today about an important and brand new publication as part of the Rutledge's Hindu Studies series. It's a brand new 2020 publication, and it's a publication of a translation of the Vaisheshika Sutra. For those of you who know what that is and might be excited, that's wonderful. And for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, we're going to explain the significance of this ancient Sanskrit text. Perhaps that might be a good place to start, actually. Will one of you maybe share, what is the Vaisheshika Sutra?
Actually, Vaisheshika Sutra is the starting point of the Vaisheshika school of Indian philosophy. And it is a very important school. In later years, Nyaya and Vaisheshika, both these schools were mixed together. But originally, these two schools were different, and Vaisheshika Sutras, they formed the beginning of that school. Particularly in the text called Tarka Sangraha, we find that there is a mixture of both the Nyaya as well as Vaisheshika systems. Although originally they were two different systems, later on they were mixed and they were not considered to be different from each other. And in general, we can call it the Indian logic. And to some extent, we can also call it Indian physics.
So this is one of the six classical schools of ancient India, the Darshanas.
Yes.
Many of you in the audience will have heard, of course, of Yoga, Sankhya. Vaisheshika is one of these six Darshanas. It is classically where we find these brilliant aphorisms pertaining to logical thinking. So it's a fascinating text.
Yes.
Does one of you want to tell us... on the podcast, we've spoken with other authors who work with Sanskrit texts. Some of those texts need to be reconstructed. Some of them are critical editions. Some of them are a particular recension. How do you start off in this project? Is there an established text, or are you establishing one in this work?
It is already established text, and it is well known. It was published long back. By Gaikwad Oriental series. In that series, that book was published. And the real contribution of this school is also enhanced by the commentary on this Vaisheshika Sutra text. And in the book which has been published by us, Dr. Moise and myself, it contains the translation and explanation of the sutras, of the commentary, and the philosophical school as a whole.
Are there other translations in English?
Yes, there are several translations in English, but they were quite out of date. The first one is Sinha, which was published in the beginning of the 20th century. And then there have been others attempts at translating in Hindi. And Professor Shashi Prabha Kumar of Delhi University is expert in that kind of literature because of her expertise in Hindi language. And of course, the latest is the 2003 by Thakur, but his translation is rather eclectic. What he did was to translate the sutras, which he compiled from several sources, and adding under beneath each an eclectic commentary, translation, paraphrase of several commentators of Vaisheshika Sutra. Vaisheshika Sutra developed in at least three traditions, according to my classification. One is the tradition of Chandrananda. The other one is Prashastapada tradition, which is more more of an innovator, a reformer of Vaisheshika Sutra, 5th, 6th century. And then we have the independent tradition, which spread in Chinese Buddhist world up to Japan. A colleague of mine from Vilnius University wrote a thesis on that kind of reception of Vaisheshika in this world, Chinese and Japanese. There have not been translations on Chandrananda, which is the most important commentator of Vaisheshika. Why? First of all, because he's relatively early, 7th to 10th century AD, according to Achlukar, is a professor from Canada, who might hear us today. But there is a Chinese scholar from the University of Shenzhen University, China. Her name is Huan Huanghe. She is a professor who looked at Chandrananda and translated this commentary into Chinese. So we did not have an English translation. Therefore, I believe that what we did is, with all its flaws, it's an important event for Indian philosophical studies.
The reason I asked the question about other translations is to underscore the significance of what's been produced, which is an accessible modern English translation, including the transliteration of the original sutras. It really is an important resource for anyone studying Vaisheshika or the Darshanas or who might be interested in Indian philosophy. Could you tell us a little bit about the
point? I may add one point.
Absolutely.
It is not only translation, but explanation also. So a text, philosophical text like Vaisheshika Sutra, translation is only the beginning of the study, but explanation is more important, and detailed explanation in a modern language like English is very useful, because most of the readers in India as well as in other countries, they can understand English, and with the help of this translation and these explanatory notes, introduction, etc., they will be able to understand this philosophical school in a very proper manner. That is what we expect.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about that process of the parsing or the commentary. Like, how did you how did you ascertain sort of what the verse would mean, or what did you, what resources did you draw on to produce that?
We first need to give a literal meaning of every word, because many times it happens, particularly in Indian languages, that the scholars, when they translate, they keep the original words as they are and only add Hindi or Marathi suffixes. So that doesn't explain the point at all. But when a proper English word has been given, then at least some idea will be possible in the mind of the reader. And further, when explanation is given, he can properly understand the exact purpose and the meaning of that sutra and the philosophical significance of that sutra.
Anuj, you're about to say something?
I wanted to say that the main problems we had when translating or revising the translations, which Professor Tita helped me to do, I had a rough translation, but it was not trustworthy. So I came to Professor Tita to help me to revise it. And we did it in a very memorable setting. The problems we had, and we did not fully agree all the time, was which kind of translation we should take. Professor Tite proposed, like a philologist and Indologist as he is, to have a very literal translation, word by word, if I well understood. Whereas what I wanted is to make a more readable, a more intelligible and even philosophical translation. This is what I wanted to put forward, to contextualize an Indian text into a world philosophical language. That was the main tension we had. Finally, we agreed about the readability of this translation after Professor Tite gave me feedback from...
My position in this respect is that the translation should be philological, but the explanation should be philosophical. And in this way, when both these methods, philological as well as philosophical, these methods, they come together, then the text becomes readable as well as... possible to be understood by a reader who has not been acquainted with the school of philosophy and also who is not expert in Sanskrit language also. He will, even if he reads only English, he will be able to understand the main contents of this text.
You know, yes, and also I wanted to say that in order to do that kind of positive compromise, was for what I did was to put in brackets or remind the reader the subject, which is always which is often not mentioned by the sutras. So I had to put in brackets what is the subject about, because translating ad literam, word by word, it is intelligible only for that passage, but not for the broader picture. So it's always good to remind, between brackets, what was the subject.
Well, we touch on this theme. We have touched on this theme in a number of podcasts, the act of translating literally versus conveying a sense. I find that many folks really, it's difficult to appreciate how much work goes into this process. Or using Sanskrit texts in many other disciplines, the text is established in a very different way. And with Sanskrit texts, there's a great deal of work that goes into ascertaining the text one will use, the parsing, the translation project. And I think it's really difficult to convey to many scholars in other subfields and beyond Hindu studies that just arriving at a text to work with in English is a feat. I mean, that's an enormous feat. And that's what this publication has accomplished. It's making available these sutras to the English-speaking world in an accessible way, and that's not a small thing. right? That's something that hasn't really come into existence before. So I just wanted to underscore that for listeners to understand the significance of what a work like this is doing. I had meant to ask you in terms of the process. I mean, you touched on it in passing, which is great, but what is the process like for when you're going from the Sanskrit Sutra to trying to render it into English? Is there a particular stringent process you undergo? Do some of you take some verses? Do both of you take a pass at all the verses? What's that process like?
As I mentioned just now, first we try to give a literal translation. And that translation, which is faithful grammatically also, and which is translating each and every word, taking into consideration the literal meaning of that word. And this may be somewhat artificial English language also. But in that way, we are faithful to the original text. And while explaining, then we can use the modern English language through which a reader can understand the concept. So we try to do justice to the original text from its literal point of view as well as its philosophical contents. So from that point of view also. And that is the contribution of this text or this book to the Indian philosophical studies.
I would like to complete and add something which Professor Tita just said. In translating, when translating commentaries with sutras, aphorism plus commentary, there are two ways to go about. One is, for example, to translate the sutra in the light of the commentary. This is one approach, only in the light of the commentary itself, and the second approach is to translate, to be aware at least about two layers of the text. First, sutra, which were created several centuries before the commentary, and the commentary itself. So I am of the opinion that when we translate sutra-based commentaries, one should be aware about this time gap, but also about the conceptual gap that exists between them. What is in the commentary is not really and fully the teaching of the original tenets. So always I had in mind to reconstruct, on the one hand, the sutra philosophy, the philosophy of sutra only, and the philosophy several centuries after of the commentary. Not all the time they agree. So it's the way in which I approach this text personally.
Is there ever consultation with traditions who use the text currently?
Yes, indeed. They are, because as I put in the at the end of the book itself, in the chart I gave, I have mentioned sources that mention either, mentioned by Vaisheshika Sutra, either to refute it or to approve it. So they are the so-called exonymic references to Vaisheshika in Buddhist and Jaina sources. And in order to reconstruct the earliest tenets of the sutra and the commentary, one should go into other sutras or early commentaries like Bhava Viveka Tarkacvala or Dignaga Pramana Samuchaya, Malavadin Vadasharanaya Chakram, a Jaina text, another Jaina text, Jinabhadra Vishesha Vashya Bhashya, Eroha Gupta Shadulukka, another Jaina text. So it's important, and all philologists and Indologists know that for reconstructing an Indian text, one should go into rival schools and texts.
Are there current schools of lived traditions that you're aware of who keep alive this tradition?
Professor Tita?
Now also, there are numerous scholars who study all the texts in the philosophical systems, namely Mimamsa or Vedanta or Nyaya, Vaisheshika, etc. And they generally study the text which belong to the later age. That is the text which have been written perhaps in 17th or 18th century, or at the most 16th century. In comparison to this, the text which has been dealt with by us is comparatively older text. And that is the beginning of the Vaisheshika philosophy. So from the point of the view of the history of Vaisheshika school, this text should be studied first, and then only later on other texts should be studied. But in practice, people study the original sutra texts at the last stage, and other texts which are comparatively later, they are studied first. And sometimes they neglect the original text also, and they give all their concentration on the later texts, which are very difficult, and they consider it to be a kind of their qualification, that they can understand these difficult texts. They can go on discussing these texts and so on. But the original texts are neglected. But here, Vaisheshika Sutra is one of the original texts, and it is also there is also a good commentary of Chandrananda there. So therefore, an effort is made to explain and translate this text. And that is why this contribution of this text is very significant.
What do you include in the appendices?
We had the three appendices. One is what I call the Vaisheshika and world philosophy. And I'm going to explain why I put these three appendices. The second is the history of Vaisheshika scholasticism, as far as I could glean from the expert literature. And finally, what I made a contribution for people who will come after us and try to put together a critical edition of Vaisheshika Sutra of Chandrananda, as reproduced by Chandrananda. And I helped by providing the location of all these manuscripts. And I am hoping that people in India, who scholars in India who listen to us now, would like to look up into their library, photograph these manuscripts, either make themselves a critical edition, or send to me these manuscript photographs, at least for my own collection. Because it's important to have all these manuscripts I have described in Appendix 3 in order to put together a critical edition of Vaisheshika Sutra. So the appendix number 3 refers to Vaisheshika Sutra only, not to the commentaries. So for me, it's very important to following Albrecht Wessler proposal. It's very important for me to establish first the sutra text and then go into the manuscript. Although, who knows, a good commentary might reveal us a better sutra text than the sutra manuscripts we have in Indian and Western libraries. But the first appendix, which is important, and it's my idea, has the role to put Vaisheshika in a world philosophical context. And for me, translation or philosophy must be contextual and also comparative, as well as philological. It is not sufficient to do only philology, but also to do what I like to call conceptual translations. Many people dismiss comparative philosophy nowadays, either because it's too hard, one needs several languages, or because it's too superficial. However, comparative philosophy is a translation and is contextualization. And for that, we need to put together a world philosophical language and vocabulary. And appendix number one is aiming at putting Vaisheshika on the map of world philosophy. Of course, it's not complete, this map, because there are African traditions or Latin American tradition, Chinese philosophical tradition, which have not been mentioned here. But my point was exactly that, putting Vaisheshika and Indian philosophy in a world context in order to understand it as a philosophy, not only as a tradition or as a Hindu tradition.
That's a fascinating idea. One of the things I often talk about in more so courses, I think, in the odd public talk is sort of how do we bring together world traditions in a meaningful way. So with this perhaps visionary and noble quest to have a world philosophy and a language thereof, one wonders would the premises behind the categorization stem from Western philosophy or Indian philosophy or neither or both? What is the container for such a language, or would there be one? Would it be tied to a particular tradition? These are just questions that come to mind.
Well, as far as ontology and metaphysics go, each philosophical system has its own system of classifying substances. Each system, each tradition has its own point of view of seeing the natural world. And that from that particular point of view, one should look at each one of those traditions. For example, if we go into Neoplatonism, we have the five categories of Porphyry, which he borrowed from Aristotle for predicables. So each robust metaphysical system has its own category. And what I try to do with Vaisheshika is to present its own categories and explain them from an Indian point of view first, and second, from a comparative point of view. Because as I said, concepts and categories must be translated or are translatable, are not only, I believe that concepts can be translated, such as translation is possible. Professor Tite?
Yes, comparative method is very useful. In order to understand, for example, Indian philosophy, we must also compare it with Greek philosophy and the other philosophies also in the world. And similarly, in order to understand the other philosophies, the understanding or the knowledge of Indian philosophy will also be helpful. So this comparative outlook is very much useful in order to have a complete picture of the problems and their answers.
I was hoping we would maybe share an aphorism or two. I mean, there's so much richness in them. It's for those who don't have a concept of what Vaisheshika is doing or how it operates, if there was one or two aphorisms that come to mind that we can share with the listeners, I think that would be brilliant.
Well, I should probably start, since I have the book under my eyes, and to read the first three aphorisms, which are fundamental, because they, or perhaps the first four, because they are fundamental for the structure of the system. So it begins from the most universal concept, Dharma, which contains also a pluralistic meaning. So Dharma is both universal but also pluralistic, in the sense there are many dharmas. So substances in the world are defined by dharmas, are not just anti-avishesha, ultimate specificity, but they are known through a dharma-vishesha, which dharma-vishesha is obtained through yogic practice. So intellection, intuition, yogic intuition plays a very important cognitive role in understanding the essence of the world, and also to liberate us from the world. And that's why the first aphorism says, now, therefore, we shall explain Dharma. Second aphorism, Dharma is that from which there is achievement of elevation and liberation. Third aphorism, the authority of sacred text is because these represent the speech of that being God or the Absolute. The fourth aphorism, earth, water, luster, air, vacuum, time, space, soul, mind, these are the substances of Vaisheshika philosophy. And then aphorism five goes on listing qualities. So you see here being three or four important concepts being explained. Dharma, which is probably the hardest. Second, liberation. Third, the authority of the text. Who? And then fourthly, the list of substances. And then the list of qualities and list of action. If you, those who listen to us know philosophy, at least in the manner in which Aristotle put it, when he talked about four categories: definition, substance, quality, and another one which I forgot now. But he also talked about 10 forms of predication, the category, and he provided, for example, a way in which to define the nature of the world through substances, through qualities, through actions. These are categories of Vaisheshika too. We don't have to study Aristotle to understand Indian metaphysics, but you see striking classifications here, which makes sense. I mean, it's a very systematic, analytical form. Analytical philosophy has not been the invention of Western or Greek philosophy or Aristotle, has been developed independently in India too. And this is Vaisheshika, for example, talks about six categories, which it explains in detail.
Excellent. Was there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on?
Here, one thing may be noted, that dharma or religion has been defined by Vaisheshika Sutra in a very secular manner. This point has to be noted because it defines dharma as something which helps us to progress in this world as well as to get liberation. But generally, the religion consists of the mythology and ritual and some ethos. But here there is no reference to mythology, there is no reference to any ritual and so on. So this is the definition which we can call the most secular definition of religion, which we will not find anywhere in any other text. And that is the importance of Vaisheshika school, that it is a very realistic school and practical school of philosophy.
That's fascinating. So before we close, tell us, just to drive the point home, who is this book for? Who do you think would most benefit from reading this book?
I think any student of philosophy, he should read this, because it is one of the basic texts of Vaisheshika school. And before going into other details, he should first try to understand the basic tenets of the Vaisheshika school, which have been clearly defined and which have been clearly explained in this text, in the form of sutra as well as the form of commentary. That is the significance of this book.
Yes. All philosophy students who are interested in metaphysics and ontology first and metaphysics second, I know that in English language they don't draw this difference between the ontology and metaphysics, but there is one, because Vaisheshika is a science of being, and if one wishes to begin studying philosophy, then they should start first with this question: what is being? What is substance? How can be known it? How can be predicated? In which way? How can be known it? So, all philosophy students who are interested in fundamental concepts related to the world in which we live and other worlds, possible worlds.
Fantastic. Thank you both for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Yonut Moise and Dr. Ganesh Tite on their brand new 2021 Rutledge Hindu Studies series publication, the Vaisheshika Sutra, a translation. Until next time, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating being itself. Take care.